Tidings, and I'm Hazel Kahn with my guest Isabella Tree, speaking to us on Skype from South England. Welcome to Tidings, Isabella Tree.
I've just finished reading Wilding, the most wonderful book. I mean, it's a mind-blowing book that I hope everybody's going to end up reading if you haven't read it already. So, Isabella, let's just talk by you telling our audience what you did and why you did it in this Wilding project, which sometimes you also refer to as rewilding.
Well, my husband and I inherited an estate, 3,500 acres of farmland in West Sussex, here in southeast England, in the 1980s, from his grandparents. And we took it on. We were early in our 20s then, fully expecting to be farmers for the rest of our lives. The problem was that the farm was already losing money. For 17 years, we tried to make it work, and we bought bigger machinery, we invested in infrastructure, we did what every good farmer is supposed to do. We tried different varieties of crops, we even tried to diversify into ice cream. But everything we seemed to do just couldn't turn the farm around. And the reason was our very heavy clay. We're on 320 meters of this stuff. It's like porridge in the winter, and in the summer it bakes as hard as concrete, and you can literally put your finger through the cracks up to your shoulder. It's so hard. So it's unforgiving stuff, and it really, this land was never meant to be intensively farmed. It just was put under the plow during the Dig for Victory campaign in the Second World War, and it was farmed ever since, really intensively in that way, thanks to farming subsidies. So it's very much a sort of false idea of what this land should be doing.
What had it been doing all those centuries?
Most of it was permanent pasture, so it's very good for cattle and for dairy. A lot of it, between the wars, was just allowed to scrub up because it wasn't worth being productive. We also have, you know, huge numbers of water meadows, so land that's so boggy that you wouldn't even want to try and farm it. But, you know, in the Second World War, of course, in desperate times, that was put under the plough as well. It was never good farmland, even then.
When you started doing the intensive farming, what were you thinking? You knew all this, right?
We didn't really understand about the soil, to be honest. I think we probably put it down to Charlie's grandparents, actually, in a very kind of naive young person's kind of a way. We assumed that, you know, they hadn't invested in infrastructure, which was true. It was still farmed in a very old-fashioned way. They were subsidizing it with money from elsewhere. They never really looked at the balance sheet. You know, the technology had moved on. Charlie was fresh out of agricultural college. He had the tools at his disposal to really turn this business around and to bring it into the 20th century and to make it an efficient and economic farm. But it took us 17 years of doing our utmost to turn it around to realize that actually what we were fighting all the time was our clay, was our heavy clay soils. We couldn't sow spring crops in a bad, wet winter. Sometimes you couldn't get heavy machinery onto the land for 6 months of the year. So you literally could not ever compete with lands on lovely, loamy soils, especially in a market that was becoming increasingly global. So it took us 17 years to realize that. But Charlie then made the very big, bold decision to give up farming entirely and to look for something else. It was a big decision, I think, because it's still very much in his family's DNA to be farming in some way. And also there's still this prevailing idea that we should be ploughing up our land throughout Britain and using it for maximum production, irrespective of whether the land is suitable for it or not. We're still very much in kind of crisis mode.
Which you attribute to World War II thinking.
It's to farming subsidies, really. Farming subsidies have really taken over from World War II, across Europe too. So Europe spends more than 40% of its whole budget on farming subsidies. And that is really driving, incentivizing farmers to grow crops in places where otherwise it would be uneconomic to do so. And what we've seen as a result of that policy is huge environmental loss, massive soil degradation, flooding, loss of biodiversity, collapse in pollinating insects. And of course, this is all bound up with chemical farming. It's something that we really have to rethink now, and we are just beginning to rethink. And I think in the States, you have wonderful pioneers in farming who are showing the way. People like Gabe Brown and David Montgomery, Joel Salatin are showing that actually farming without chemicals and without plowing can be as productive food-wise as conventional farming, but it can also restore our soils and restore water and have this massive knock-on effect for biodiversity.
You also say in the book this need to farm every inch is also a feeling that there's not enough food. And in fact, there's too much food, one might add, with all the waste and all the overproduction and, well, you know.
That's absolutely it. And I think this is the sort of elephant in the room, really, that the food and farming industry don't want us to appreciate, is that we currently produce enough food for 10 billion people, 11 billion people, some statistics say. But even if it's 10, that's 2.5 billion people more than are alive on the planet today. Mm. And so we are overproducing. And recently I was driving up the coast of California with my husband, and, you know, we were seeing huge groves of oranges and grapefruit that were just not going to be harvested this year because the commodity price had fallen. Mm. We were seeing crops of red peppers, some of which had had a blight, but most of the red peppers were perfectly edible, but they were not worth being harvested. So globally, we are still overproducing, and we're producing in the wrong way that is unsustainable. But for us here in Sussex, after 17 years, even with farming subsidies of making losses, we realized that we just couldn't go on as we were. And we really wanted to look at a way of working with the land rather than battling against mm-hmm. it all the time.
Bullying
it. Yes, exactly. And that's when we hit upon the idea of doing nature conservation, but really in a different way. We were very much inspired by a wonderful Dutch ecologist, Frans Veerer. And his book, Grazing Ecology and Forest History, was published in English in 2000, which was the year that we had our farm machinery sale and we sold our dairy herds and our milk quota, and we finally cleared our debt. And it was no coincidence that, I think, because meeting him at that moment, we were suddenly free from this burden of losses, but also free from the mindset of farming. We were suddenly open-minded and could look at what he was saying in a much more interested and imaginative way.
Yeah, because if you'd heard him a year or two before that, you wouldn't have heard him.
Precisely. Yeah, yeah. We might have thought, well, that's quite interesting, but it's not for us.
Yeah.
And what really interested us, we, you know, in all our imaginings of what our world looked like before human impact, we've largely forgotten about the huge numbers of free-roaming megafauna that would have been here. And I think this is true for the States too. We've completely forgotten that sort of shifting baseline of amnesia of what centuries and centuries ago our landscape would have looked like before we hunted to extinction the megafauna.
Who are the megafauna?
In Europe, we're talking about the aurochs, the ancestor of the modern cow, the great original ox, mm-hmm. and tarpan, the original horse. Bison, of course, European bison. They were hunted to extinction in the wild, but they are now coming back, European bison, thanks to about 12, I think, individuals that were in zoos in the 20th century. And now they're beginning to be used to seed rewilding projects in Europe. Mm. Hugely important keystone species, the bison. Beavers were almost hunted to extinction in Europe. We were down to about 1,200 individuals in 8 relict populations, a whole of Eurasia.
What were they hunted for? Their fur?
For their fur, just like they were in the States, for their fur, but also for castoreum. It's in their scent glands, and it's a very powerful medicine. And it's largely because beavers consume willow along the riverbanks, and willow has salicylic acid in it, which is what we get aspirin from. And so it's concentrated in the castoreum, in these glands, in these scent stacks. And so in the past, it was a very effective medicine. It was an analgesic, basically. Mm. So it was hunted to almost extinction. And then, of course, you would have had red deer in huge numbers, elk. Really, so what Frans is saying is that these animals would have lived in temperate zone Europe in numbers similar to the kind of huge herds of animals that you see somewhere like the Serengeti. Mm. But we've completely forgotten about them. And these animals in huge herds would have been driving the creation of habitat. So they would have been migrating, their impact on the land, the trampling, rootling, of course, in the case of wild boar, we would have had wild boar, you know, in the hundreds of thousands. And the way they trash the vegetation, the way they debark trees, the way they brush through scrub, the way they carry seeds in their hooves and their gut and their fur, the way they transport minerals around the landscape. And of course, their dung and their urine has a huge impact on the soil and rejuvenating the soil. And even carcasses rotting down in the landscape, again, has a huge impact on soil and that whole nutrient cycle. So if you want to recover biodiversity, which we know has been collapsing, and in the UK now we're looking at across the board, our biodiversity has fallen 60% since 1970. And a huge proportion of our wildlife is facing extinction, including charismatic birds like the turtle dove and the nightingale. We're about to lose them from our shores altogether. If we're wanting to recover biodiversity, the way to do that, France is saying, is to allow these free-roaming herbivores to have free reign of the landscape again, allow them to regenerate habitat, to create that dynamism that we're missing. But we need to sort of think about how to add that dynamism, how to kickstart natural processes again. And large herbivores really are a fantastic way to do that. And so that's what we thought we got very excited by. We thought, well, you know, this could be a very low-cost way of getting nature back into our landscape here at NEP. We allowed a sort of vegetation pulse to happen to begin with initially. So essentially taking after the last harvest, after we decided to stop farming, we weren't brave enough to do it all in 1 year. It took us about 6 years to withdraw from farming completely. But we left the fields after their last harvest, and that just allowed, you know, thorny scrub to start pulsing through the soil again. So blackthorn, hawthorn, bramble, dog rose. And slowly you started to see oaks appearing in that thorny scrub. So, you know, your jay, the bird that can plant 6,000 acorns, one single bird can plant 6,000 acorns in 4 weeks. So after about 6 or 7 years of allowing this thorny scrub to pulse up, we then ring-fenced the whole area and then started to introduce our free-roaming animals. Obviously, we haven't got the aurochs or the tarpan anymore because we hunted them to extinction, but you can use domesticated proxies. You can use their descendants. We have the domesticated cow, and in our case, we use the Old English longhorn, which looks a bit like an aurochs. It's got these wonderful upsweeping horns, and it looks quite wild. And then we use Exmoor ponies as a stand-in for the tarpan. And again, they're a very old breed, very wild, so they can survive outside all year round without supplementary feeding. There's no buildings out there for them anymore, so they have to be quite hardy. They have to be able to see it through a British winter. So, I mean, we do actually have a couple of barns out there, but they never use them. They much prefer, you know, sort of hunkering down underneath trees or in dips and hollows. They make their own shelter. And we introduced Tamworth pigs to stand in for wild boar, and then fallow deer and red deer. And the whole idea is that the more animals, the more megafauna you have like this, the more complex the habitats become, because they all have different grazing and different browsing preferences. The way they eat is completely different, and they're choosing, selecting different plants. And also their effect on the environment is very different. Their behaviors are different.
But when you said effect, they are both the cause and effect, aren't they? The diversity of the environment follows the animals. They didn't come because it was there. They created it in some way.
Yes, this is, I think, something that we tend to forget, is that after the last ice age, for example, when the ice was withdrawing back towards the Arctic cap, the species were beginning to recolonize Northern Europe and Britain. It was the animals that came back first, because they're more mobile. It was the megafauna that came back first. Mm. The trees took thousands of years to move north. And so what the animals are doing is they are actually creating the habitat that actually enabled the trees as well to thrive. They were first. It's, I think when you look at it post-Ice Age, you can see how important the megafauna are for the sort of evolution of the species, the flora that co-evolved with them.
Isabella Tree is talking about her book, Wilding. This is Tidings on WPKN Radio. It's a partnership. They coexist.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they've coexisted for millennia.
Yeah.
It's just that we've forgotten that. We look at our landscapes today, and if we appreciate that there's some sort of ecological loss going on there, we probably look back to our childhood when, you know, we remember hearing nightingales and turtle doves, or when we had hedgehogs in the garden and they've completely disappeared, or cuckoos, we don't hear them anymore. Or perhaps our parents used to tell us about how there used to be hundreds of lapwing in their day, and the cornfields were full of cornflowers and poppies. That's as far back as we kind of go. And we forget that there was much, much, much more. We forget that, you know, in their great-grandparents' day, there would have been nightjars down every country lane. We would have had beavers, and the North Sea would have once been as clear as gin. We would have had huge oyster beds keeping it all clean. We would have had huge shoals of herring coming almost like a tidal wave that you could actually see when the herring were migrating. And in their wake would have been tuna and even great white shark. We don't think about that in British waters today because we have no inkling that they were had ever been there. We completely forget. We only have a memory that seems to last a generation or two. And I think in terms of conservation, that's important because we should be much greedier. We should be much, much more ambitious of thinking what we could get back. We have such a demand now for people wanting to come and see the wildlife that's come back that we have a safari and camping business, an ecotourism business. So it's sort of based along an African model. My husband grew up in Africa and we used to travel the ends of the earth to look at wonderful wildlife. And we never once thought about how we should be having wildlife in our own backyard. And of course, now we have it. Wonderful, exotic creatures in our own backyard here. Why don't we have, you know, safaris like Africa with open-sided vehicles where you can go out and look at this wonderful British wildlife? We haven't quite got the African weather, but people don't seem to mind. We are open from Easter till the end of October, so it's in the relatively clement months. So what you see then is herds of free-roaming red deer and fallow deer and longhorn cattle and Exmoor ponies. And, you know, we take it for granted now, but, you know, people are so surprised seeing cattle behaving like a wild animal. You know, they will toss their head in the branches of sallow and smear their faces with sallow sap so to keep the insects away. They will carve down in hollows and leave their calves in little nests while they go off and graze with the herd. They're behaving like completely different creatures to the rather boring animals we look at in our very static farming system. And then we've got Tamworth pigs rootling around. We never know where they're going to be. They have a sort of completely independent life. Again, you see these extraordinary behaviours in de-domesticated animals when they're allowed free rein to express themselves. We watch our pigs behaving almost like hippos. They spend a lot of time in the water. They can actually hold their breath. They can dive underwater. We've timed them holding their breath for about 12 seconds. What they're really looking for is freshwater mussels. So that's what they absolutely love. And how they knew they were even at the bottom of our ponds, we have no idea. But that's what they're looking for. The impact of these animals, the rootling of the pigs that opens up the heavy grass sward that allows more seeds to fly in and germinate. It's the way the animals break branches or carefully browse, very closely browse the thorny scrub that encourages more vegetation complexity, but also niches for other wildlife. So places where birds can come in and hide themselves in that very thick, dense, closely cropped, thorny scrub. They can find perfect nesting places to protect themselves from predation. And so it's a very complex habitat out there now. It looks much more like, you know, the African bush than your classic British countryside. And that's where we're seeing these enormous increases, not just in biomass, because as you go out there now on a spring day, and the sound of birdsong is so strong, you can literally feel it reverberating in your stomach. But it's also the rarity of the species that's come back that I think has astonished us. We've now got, as you know, nightingales and turtle doves, our most critically endangered birds. We've got peregrine falcons nesting in a tree, which is almost unheard of. We've got so many red data species that, you know, we literally have people out there all summer long trying to count them and writing reports on them. From being literally, I would say, one of the most degraded pieces of land in lowland Britain, chemically abused for decades and underneath the Gatwick stacking system, in less than 20 years, we've become one of the most significant areas for nature in Britain. Mm. And so what we've shown, I think, is if it can happen here, it can happen anywhere. And it's relatively easy and relatively low cost, and it's an incredibly swift process. Nature will bounce back if you let it.
As you wrote somewhere about this, you had to learn how to sit on your hands so as not to intervene in what was happening, because the whole idea is to let it happen the way it's supposed to happen.
That's the main difference between us, I think, and conventional conservation. We're seeing that conventional conservation is obviously failing. That's not to say it's not important. You know, we have these little Noah's Arks, as it were, of areas that have been preserved by intense human management in an effort to preserve species or even habitats. And without that effort, we would have lost many more species than we have. They're very isolated, those habitats, mm-hmm. and they're really doomed to fail if those populations are left in tiny pockets. What we need is for those areas to be joined up, to be connected, so that populations of species can move again. They can become dynamic and resilient in the face of climate change and pollution, and they can actually react and perform again in a much more dynamic way. So how do you provide that webbing of nature? How do you actually connect these nature reserves together again to make them effective? And I think that's what we've shown at NEP. The process here is very much a hands-off approach. Of course, it's incredibly expensive to be managed for nature, but it's also, I think, in many ways unnecessary, because if you allow free-roaming animals to manage for nature, if you allow them to manage the area, to keep the scrub in check, to react with the trees, so you don't get too much tree cover, you don't get too little, to open up habitat for other species, then you can sit back on your hands and relax a bit. You don't have to play God anymore. Mm. You can actually allow the megafauna to do what they've been doing for millennia. And they do it in a much better, much more effective way. But that, I think, for human beings is very difficult to do. We are workaholics, and we like to intervene. We like to feel we're doing something. And it's a very difficult lesson to learn that actually one of the most positive things you can do for nature, once you have the right conditions in place, is to sit back on your hands and do nothing.
Mm. How has all of this changed you? You're letting wilding happen around you. It must be happening in some way, I'm guessing, within you as well. How are you different?
It's a very interesting question. It's a wonderful place to live now, where we are. And so I think, quite simply, we're much happier. Mm. I think, you know, certainly running a loss-making business, as the farm was a nightmare. Mm. And we were constantly stressed and endlessly, you know, chasing our tails and deeply unhappy. And I think that, you know, doing what we have done now, we walk out there on a summer's day and we can hear turtle doves touring in the thickets. We can hear the insects and the smell of clean air, and it makes you just feel glad to be alive. I think also the way we've done it with this very hands-off approach has meant that we are much less intrusive. We tend to sit back and trust nature, and I think that in itself is quite an unburdening sort of freedom, because I think you begin to feel that in your personal life too. I think you become much more trusting of events and that things will sort themselves out somehow, and not trying to force issues too much. So I think that has had an effect. It's obviously a double-edged sword, though. I think, you know, we do live in a bubble now. We're lucky enough to have nature on our doorstep now. But when we go to places, even, you know, where I grew up in my childhood in Dorset, which I loved, and I go back to places where I always used to love to walk, and what I notice now is the silence and the lack of life. I think seeing how much life there is here at NEP now just makes us realize how much there isn't in the rest of the landscape. And that is very wounding. I think it's very depressing. We know it can bounce back very quickly, nature, if you let it. And that is the main hope. And I think the response of people who come to NEP and get inspired by that is also contributes to that feeling of hope. But we do just have to do it and get on with it and quickly. And so, you know, there's that worry too, that are we doing things fast enough? Can we get this message out there and really inspire people to feel that they can do something in their own backyard too?
I thought you might say that the speed, that the urgency is because of climate change, but that's not what you're saying, I don't think.
It is completely, it's urgent, and I think climate change has been happening for decades, and we should have been thinking about this long, long ago. Mm. But I think that the climate change urgency is beginning to hit people, and you know, we've seen Extinction Rebellion, you know, Greta Thunberg, the plastics revolution. This is all happening in the last couple of years. And I think suddenly people are feeling that we have to change now and that we're not going to simply trust our governments to carry on as before. We have to force their hand and really push this at them. I think that's very, very encouraging. And I think what NEP shows more than anything is that we can achieve something very quickly if we have the will to do it. And everybody can contribute. You know, if you have a tiny piece of land, whether it's a small farm or an orchard or even a backyard in a city, if you go chemical free, if you start thinking in terms of getting messy and allowing a bit of thorny scrub, a few scrubby patches here and there, not tidying up your dead wood, all this can have an impact, and particularly if you can connect with other people. I have a friend who has a backyard in Bristol, and he has connected with his neighbours so that he's cut a hedgehog hole tunnel through the hedges and the fences of his neighbours so that now that is a wildlife corridor. And one of his neighbours has a sandbank, another has a pond. And so between them in this street in Bristol, they now have a really effective wildlife corridor with different habitats. And if you can connect that with a railway embankment or a canal or a towpath and then connect it to an inner city park, suddenly you can have a wildlife corridor going from an inner city park out through that city and back into the countryside and into rewilded areas. And so if you have hedgehog holes, hedgehogs can come and go as they please. You know, it's just thinking about how to connect, how are creatures going to be able to move around our landscape again. And part of that, I think, is it's trying to forget that aesthetic where we're endlessly wanting to tidy up. Why do we have to have lawns that look like billiard tables? Why don't we allow some wildflowers into those lawns? Why don't we let the lawns grow longer and mow less frequently? What about our garden paths? Could we let them get, you know, a bit rougher and around the edges? Trying to rewild ourselves is how I think I'd put it.
Yeah. So thank you very much. Just tell people if they do want to get in touch with you, what they should do.
The easiest thing is to go to our website, which is www.nep, which is spelled KNEPP.co.uk. And you can find all about us on there. You can see how to book if you want to come on safari or come glamping or camping. And you can also see all our monitoring surveys and our reports. And also, just broadly speaking, you can read about the estate and the history of the estate and how we've got to where we are today.
Thank you very much then, Isabella. Isabella Tree of NEP Estate in Sussex in the UK. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Very nice to talk to you too.
You've been listening to Isabella Tree talk about her book, Wilding. You can hear tidings on the second Wednesday of every month at 7:30 p.m. All Tidings programs are produced by Tony Ernst and available as podcasts on hazelcarn.com.